We have the pleasure today in our program to have an author. It's called Earl de Blonville. Hi. Bonjour.
Bonjour.
We're here to talk about your book, Savage Coast. It's all about those explorers. Are you an explorer yourself? You look like an explorer.
Yes,
I can't really see on radio, but you do look
well,
like
that's right. I feel like an explorer sometimes.
Yeah.
But where do you get them these days?
I don't know. On TV sometimes. talk to us about your book, Savage Coast.
Well, Côte de Sauvage.
Côte Sauvage.
Is the story of Australia's first expedition to the Arctic.
Okay.
Australia had been involved in the Antarctic since 1895. And in fact, the first expedition to ever set foot on the Antarctic mainland left from Tasmania. It was another 90-odd years before Australia turned its eyes to the north.
Uh-huh.
Because in 1985, 86, the Arctic really didn't register with Australians at all. They never heard of it.
Yeah, it was so far away.
It was so far away.
Almost on the other side of the world.
Well, you could say that.
Exactly.
And Australia had a very strong relationship with the Antarctic, and still does, to the exclusion of what's going on in the rest of the world. So we do tend to just play in our own little backyard quite a lot. So I was motivated to take Australia's first expedition to the Arctic, to go down the east coast of Greenland, and we would be the first, as far as I'm aware, the first Europeans to ever kayak down that coast.
So we're talking kayak, we're not talking sailing.
We're talking both, actually. In order to get to Greenland, it's a very difficult place to get to, and in order to get there, we had to sail.
Mm-hmm.
We had to, first of all, fly to the UK, buy a yacht, fit it all out, build the kayaks, fill the place up with food, and then sail up through the North Atlantic to East Greenland. And I can tell you that every conceivable thing that could possibly go wrong did so.
Okay.
From violence, from money problems.
Violence?
Equipment failure.
Yes. On the boat?
On the boat.
Whoa.
Yes.
Okay.
The so-called sailing master, who turned out to not have any qualifications whatsoever, went mad one day.
Okay.
And for no reason at all, he beat me up.
Nice.
Broke three ribs.
Okay.
And it put me into an incredibly difficult position.
Absolutely.
Because I didn't know what to do. I'd never had that sort of thing happen to me before. We were in Ireland at the time. And we'd had a lot of difficulties with the boat, so maybe he just didn't want to sail any further, and this was his way of getting out of it.
Mm-hmm.
In the end, he apologised, and I accepted his apology, but I also knew that we needed him on the crew to get the boat to Greenland. So I thought, well, I'll let him stay, and when we get to Iceland, I'll flick him.
Mm-hmm.
In the end, I just didn't have the strength of character to do it.
Okay.
I was too compassionate.
So he went all the way with you?
He went all the way and very nearly killed us again.
Okay.
With some bad decisions.
I hope he's not listening.
I hope he is listening.
The Arctic and the Antarctic, are they very different to each other?
Well, you could say that they're completely different. Because
one is a land and the other one is not a land.
Exactement, yes. Antarctica is a huge landmass surrounded by a sea of ice. The Arctic is a huge sea covered in ice surrounded by landmass.
Mm-hmm.
So it's diametrically opposed. The Greenland is a wholly Arctic island. It's the world's biggest island. Australia is an island continent, so it's slightly different.
Yeah.
And Greenland's about the size of Western Australia.
Okay.
And, of course, as we know, Western Australia should belong to the French.
Exactly.
Because in 1772, French explorer called Saint-Hilaire, and he sailed at the same time as Marion de Fresnay,
mm-hmm.
and Hilaire landed in WA and formally claimed a place for France. And
so what happened?
And de Fresnay formally landed in Tasmania and also claimed Tasmania for France.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
So
what happened?
Well, I think France went through a few conniptions, yeah. A few revolutions.
So this expedition, if we come back to this expedition, what were the most adventurous thing for you, building this expedition or actually doing it?
Well, it's a good question. it took many, many years to actually plan the expedition.
Okay.
And a lot of training. So part of that was making the first circumnavigation of Tasmania in sea kayaks, a 1,600-kilometre journey over 70 days through a lot of storms and bad weather. It had never been done before, but it was sort of part of putting sea kayaking on the map. At the time we left, the newspapers and the police and everybody else said it couldn't be done. It had never been done, so therefore it couldn't be done. That's the logic in those days.
Yeah. It still is in many places, though.
Sorry?
It still is in many places.
Yes. It was difficult because there was quite a large section of the West Coast that hadn't been mapped properly. Mm-hmm. So we just had to take it as we saw it in the old-fashioned way. And we copped the biggest storm in living memory on the west coast of Tasmania, bringing 60-foot waves to smash over the coast. But what it did was it put sea kayaking on the map in Australia. And this was Australia's first modern major sea kayak expedition. And people got quite excited about it. And as a consequence of that, we were able to then raise a lot of money. Ultimately, it was about $2.5 million in today's values to launch Australia's first expedition to the Arctic.
Okay.
But there were a lot of things that had to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And building the momentum to get the support of the financiers was a long job.
So the journey itself started way, way, way before
the journey for me actually started in 1977.
Okay.
When a climbing partner in Wales in the UK just happened to mention that there was a sealskin kayak at a place in London that belonged to a young British polar explorer called Gino Watkins. And he'd been exploring there in 1930-31. He'd become an expert sea kayak paddler and hunter, and then he'd popularized the kayak after that expedition, and that's what led to the sea kayak being embraced as four expeditions. Mm-hmm. Because you can put all of your gear inside a sea kayak and you can travel for 1,000 miles. So
can you pull it on ice?
Yeah,
or
yes,
do you have to
yes.
protect it?
No, you can pull it over the ice, but okay. But what we found was if there's a lot of ice in the road, you can just hit the ice at speed, bounce up onto the top, and if you've got a couple of metal implements like an axe and a hammer, you can pull yourself along the ice and off the other side.
Okay. But and you found it yourself?
I've done it myself many times. In fact, I did it once too often,
okay.
And when we came off the other end, I capsized. I lost my tools. I lost my camera, and I very nearly lost my life.
Okay.
I was that close to dying from the cold.
Okay.
Because you're falling into water that's 2 degrees below zero,
mm-hmm.
and it just knocks the wind out of you. So you asphyxiate,
yeah.
and then you drown.
Yeah.
And the cold on your head, that cold water, is having like two bricks slamming into your head. It's okay. incredibly painful.
And quick.
And quick.
Yeah.
Yes, they don't give you very long in that sort of water.
Yeah.
And yet, a few years later, I found myself in the water for about 30 to 40 minutes trying to fix a propeller on a yacht of mine on the west coast of Greenland. And I don't know how I survived that, but okay. there you go.
Yeah. Life is an adventure.
It is.
And of course, there's two very important French explorers which you've been studying.
Absolutely, yes. Well, where we landed in East Greenland was a place called Amasalik. And Amasalik was first discovered in 1884 by a Danish explorer, Gustav Holm. But in 1934, this incredible isolated little hunting village called Amasalik was visited by French explorer Paul-Émile Victor. He was an anthropologist. And what he wanted to do was to capture the language and the culture and everything of this incredibly unique place, the only place of its kind left on Earth at that time. And he was working for the Musée de l'Homme in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
His work was still being done in 1986 by Catherine Inel. And she was, because she spoke perfect old Greenlandic and East Greenlandic, she was able to introduce us to some very important Inuit people who knew all about Gino Watkins and the kayak and who built it. And through the work of Victor, Jean-Baptiste Chacot, who took him over there, and Catherine Inel from the Musée de l'Homme, we were able to meet the man who built Gino Watkins' kayak.
Okay.
And that kayak is now probably the world's most famous because you see sea kayaks all around the world, and it all came from this old man called Ipa Kai and brought back to the world by Gino Watkins. But I could only learn about all of this through the representative of the Musée de l'Homme that was still working there on the anthropology and language.
Incredible.
Amazing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Amazing.
And you got that direct link.
That direct link.
There's, you know, those 6 degrees of separation, you only have one.
Yeah, well, we filmed Ipa Kai. Mm-hmm. So we've got all of this stuff, and he died the next year. So it was one of those incredible moments in time that you couldn't plan. You just had to have luck on your side.
Mm-hmm. Incredible.
Yeah.
The book relates the whole journey? Or does it start from the UK when you
started? No, it actually starts, the book actually opens the day that we hit Greenland in 1986, and we've arrived too late. We arrived so late that we'd completely missed the summer, and the other expeditions were all going home, and we were just getting started. Most people would have said, it's too late. We don't know when the storms are going to start, so we should just leave the boat here and go home, or just sail home. Well, we couldn't leave the boat there because the engine didn't work. We couldn't go ashore because we didn't have any money. We didn't have any food. We were basically trapped there.
Okay.
And the radio wasn't working. The compass wasn't working. The engine wasn't working. And so basically, I had this incredible decision to make. Do I just accept that we can't do anything,
mm-hmm.
or do I decide that we'll just go ahead anyway?
Okay. So you went.
I said, no, nope, we're going. We've come all this way, we're going.
Exactly.
And, of course, if we'd have put
That's
it off...
That's a true explorer in you.
If you look at how Australia was opened up with the French explorers, just sort of no maps, no idea where they were going, they just went and found these places. And then subsequently, the explorers that came out from Europe, the Leichhardts and the Giles and the Eyres and the Stuarts, and they just headed off into the middle of Australia. They had no maps. They had no previous skills. They didn't know what they were doing, and they just encountered one difficulty after the other, but they just kept going,
yeah.
And that is the nature of exploration.
Absolutely. Do you often relate to your book? You read it back, or do you like doing readings on your book? And
yes, I do.
Yeah. Memories?
Yeah.
I
well, so. The interesting thing is it took about 30 years to write the book.
Mm-hmm.
It's only just out now, and I did do another version, which was out about 8 years ago, but it took a long time to write the book. So the person who was writing the book was not the person who had just come back from the expedition.
Okay.
So I'd matured a lot, so my writing style had improved a lot, so I was so detached from it that I was writing about somebody else's expedition, not mm-hmm. my own.
Okay.
So I think it's very balanced, and I've been very interested to look at all of the leadership issues that emerge. There's hardly a couple of pages go by when some trauma didn't occur, and as a leader with no prior experience, I just had to try and work it out and keep the group together and keep us going,
mm-hmm.
even though I had no idea if what I was deciding would work or not.
Okay.
So the book actually, because it has all of these leadership moments that are examined in the book, you find these leadership moments are very analogous to business today. And they're the same sort of problems that the millennial leaders of the future are going to have to face when we have no idea what we're doing. The whole world around us is changing out of all recognition. So we have to fall back on our personal qualities as leaders. We can't rely on the rubbish that they turn out of business schools because mm-hmm. it's got nothing to do with real leadership. It's all to do with management, even though they badge it leadership. So we need to be looking to the great explorers and understand what the qualities are that enable some people to ensure that the group succeeds in what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's difficult because the leader is in the middle of the storm himself or herself at the same time as everybody else, and yet must rise above the fears and the uncertainty and somehow pull everyone together and make a decision about something they have no idea if it's going to work or not.
Mm-hmm.
That's absolutely not easy.
So the message is to the millennials is drop your lattes, drop your gluten-free avocado and toast and read your book.
I think that's a great idea.
Absolutely.
In fact, your listeners should come along to La Niche on Saturday night.
I was going to talk about this because you had a formal launch of the book at Readings.
Yes.
But now you're doing a softer launch at a cafe we all love here in the French program. It's La Niche with Anthony.
I think it's the best cafe in Melbourne, but I'm biased because it's a Breton cafe and it's full of atmosphere.
So this Saturday there's a soft launch.
Yeah. There's a soft launch. So we'll have a Breton accordionist playing some beautiful tunes from Breton.
Erwan.
I love Brittany myself and spend a bit of time there. And we'll be having some funny stories, particularly about food. And you'll have to come along to the evening to hear about how you deal with ducks when there's bears around.
Exactly. Oh, that's interesting. So it's at La Niche. That's if you're in Melbourne, because if you're in Sydney or anywhere else, it's probably a bit far. But if you're in Melbourne, then pop up to La Niche. La Niche is on Smith Street in Fitzroy.
Near Gertrude Street, yes. If you are in Sydney, just drop what you're doing and come down. Why not? Pourquoi pas?
Absolument. Earl de Blonville, it was a real pleasure talking to you.
Thank you.